Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Noam Chomsky, MIT professor of linguistics, author, and political analyst, who examines the Bush administration's motivation for the Iraq War and the choices before voters in the upcoming presidential election. Ellen Frank, senior economist at the Poverty Institute at Rhode Island College, who discusses critical economic issues in the election campaign, and Kalila Brown Dean, assistant professor of African American Studies and Political Science at Yale University, who takes a historical look at voter disenfranchisement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
An audit commissioned by the United Nations has found that 50% of the Iraqi war reconstruction funds provided primarily by the United States and spent in the first half of 2004 are not accounted for. In one transaction, $1.4 billion was deposited by Kurdish leaders in a bank in northern Iraq, but the paper trail ends there. According to the Boston Globe, auditors could not track down $1 billion given out by the U.S.-led Coalition Provisional Authority for hundreds of large and small-scale reconstruction projects. The audit performed by the big accounting firm KPMG identified many improper practices. For example, more than $100 million from the Commander's Emergency Response Program has either no contracts on file, no evidence of competitive bids, no purchase invoices or payment vouchers. The CPA also gave money to the Iraqi Finance Ministry, which kept two sets of books, and checks were made out to a senior advisor to the Health Ministry rather than to suppliers, raising questions if the money was used for the intended purposes. The Bush administration declined to comment on the audit, but Susan Rice, a foreign policy advisor to the Kerry campaign, said the audit raised major questions about the Bush policy in Iraq. She charged that waste, fraud, and abuse have become the hallmark of the Bush administration's handling of the Iraqi occupation. After handling the disputed Florida recount for the Bush campaign in 2000, James Baker, Secretary of State for President Bush Sr., returned to Texas to rejoin the Houston law firm of Baker Botts. The firm was founded by his great-grandfather, who once represented robber baron Jay Gould. In quick order, Baker brokered the Federal Trade Commission and the U.S. Treasury to rubber-stamp a deal by Russia's Norilsk Nickel to take over the Stillwater Mining Company, run by a major oligarch who controls 50% of the world's supply of platinum and palladium. Over the last decade, Baker has used his clout with George Bush Sr. to make millions for the Carlyle Group, a private equity firm with major investments in armaments and the Middle East. According to The Nation magazine, Bush and Baker worked their Saudi connections to raise cash for Carlyle. Yet Baker has refused to talk about the extent of his Carlyle holdings with the press, which is reportedly in the range of $180 million. Baker has also kept his personal fortune private, even after taking the job of renegotiating Iraq's foreign debt for the Bush administration. What is clear to many Texas lawyers is that Baker Botts has the best Saudi connections around. When two top Saudis, Defense Minister Prince Sultan bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud and his brother Prince Salman bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud were sued by survivors of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, they chose James Baker's law firm to defend them against the 9/11 families. The Los Angeles Times reports that new documents in a French criminal investigation show that Halliburton, which Vice President Dick Cheney ran in the late 1990s, was more deeply involved in a Nigerian corruption scandal than previously thought. Investigators are probing the activities of Jeffrey Tesler, a British attorney who represented an oil service consortium in Nigeria, which Halliburton joined in 1998 through the buyout of Dressler Industries. Tesler, who boasted about his close ties with Nigerian strongman General Sani Abacha, has admitted to giving $75,000 to the head of the Nigerian body that awarded a consortium a lucrative contract for a natural gas complex. Tesler is also alleged to have set up a slush fund for the $176 million in fees that he earned from the consortium of American, European, and Japanese oil service companies. The French newspaper Le Figaro has reported that Tesler has put several million dollars in a Swiss bank account controlled by Jack Stanley, who retired last year as chairman of Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg, Brown and Root. U.S. investigators are now looking to see if Halliburton has violated the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which bars American companies from bribing foreign officials. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
The Bush administration's decision to invade Iraq remains one of the central issues in the U.S. presidential election campaign. Violence there continues to escalate, resulting in growing numbers of deaths and injuries among American soldiers and Iraqi civilians. Although recent presidential debates focused on differences between President Bush and his opponent, Senator John Kerry, on the rationale for the war, the two candidates agree on the need to prosecute the conflict until victory. Meanwhile, in Iraq, U.S. forces continue an offensive against insurgents in the city of Fallujah, where hostility to the American occupation has grown after weeks of constant airstrikes. In mid-October, 18 U.S. soldiers of the U.S. Army's 343rd Quartermaster Company made headlines when they refused to deliver a shipment of fuel from the Talil Air Base near Nasiriyah to a base in Taji in the north. The soldiers, who claimed their trucks were unsafe and did not have an adequate armed escort, are now under investigation for insubordination. The incident underscores long-standing charges that many American troops in Iraq are ill-equipped and have been placed in unnecessary danger by the Pentagon's poor war planning. In his latest book, Hegemony or Survival: America's Quest for Global Dominance, MIT professor of linguistics and philosophy Noam Chomsky examines U.S. foreign policy and concludes that our government's aggressive military posture and disdain for international treaties and conventions on arms control, the environment, and human rights threaten the very survival of humankind. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Professor Chomsky, America's most honored intellectual dissident, about his views on the primary motivation for the Iraq War and the choices before voters in the November 2nd U.S. presidential election.
After the collapse of the original pretexts, weapons of mass destruction, ties to terror, and so on, a new claim surfaced, namely what the liberal press calls Bush's messianic vision to bring democracy to Iraq, the Middle East, the world, etc. And it's interesting that here in the United States, declaration was taken very seriously. In fact, you have to search hard to find any commentator who doesn't accept that that was the goal. I mean, there are critics, but the critics typically say that it's a noble and inspiring vision, but it's beyond our reach. It's not realistic. Their cultures, the Iraqi culture, isn't ready for such dramatic improvements and so on. Right at the time that the president announced his messianic vision with enormous applause here, there was a poll published, actually in the Washington Post, taken in Baghdad by Western organizations, and they had asked people, why do you think the U.S. invaded Iraq? Well, about 1% said that the goal was to establish democracy. So 1% of Iraqis agree with roughly 100% of articulate opinion here, based solely on the president's declaration. There's no other evidence for it. The rest of the people polled, most of them said that the goal was to take control of Iraq's resources, to use control of Iraq in a dependent client state, to reorganize the region in U.S. interests, which makes perfect sense. If the U.S. conquers Iraq and imposes a dependent client state, which will be called democracy, but, imperial powers quite commonly do that. They allow some degree of formal participation as long as the decisions are under control. That's what the U.S. has done for a century in its own domains locally, what the British did, and so on. So the goal would be to establish a dependent client state with democratic forms, but keeping strictly within constraints imposed by Washington and following economic policies that it imposes and so on. and with permanent U.S. military bases, stable bases, right in the heart of the world's major oil-producing regions. And before the invasion, Russia and French companies had the inside track on developing them. Okay, that's over. Now it's U.S. companies. And so they get the profits. But crucially, the U.S. gets the control. It's not a matter of access to oil, but control over it. And you go back to the, by now, declassified documents of the 1940s, and the State Department was pointing out that control over Middle East oil resources is a what they called a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the great material prizes of world history.
Sure.
It's been understood, still is. And the invasion, as Iraqis seem to understand, but we don't allow ourselves to think about, the invasion was intended to achieve that aim.
Professor Chomsky, I wondered if you talk about the differences, if any, you see between George W. Bush and Senator John Kerry on the imperial grand strategy you've written a lot about. Just another question about the election, just frame them together. As a former supporter of Ralph Nader in the 2000 election, you recently signed a letter urging progressive voters to support Kerry and Edwards in swing states. I guess, you know, to sum it up, what do you believe is at stake in this presidential election?
Well, first of all, I should correct that common misimpression. I said exactly the same thing in the year 2000, precisely the same thing.
Regarding Ralph Nader.
Yeah. I said that it's important to ensure that Bush doesn't get elected, which means in swing states you have to vote for the only viable alternative, the Democratic candidate, and what you do in safe states is has other factors enter. So I just repeated what I'd said then. I also repeated something which in my view is much more important, which is that there is a huge propaganda campaign to try to restrict political action to pushing a lever once every 4 years in a highly personalized extravaganza that's constructed by the public relations industry. We shouldn't submit to that. We should understand that what's important is to create a real democratic culture in which those choices all mean something, and that's a matter of day-to-day activity. With regard to the current choices, if you happen to be in a swing state and your vote happens to matter, you have to ask, are there significant differences between the two parties? And the answer is that there are. In the, say, the imperial grand strategy, as foreign affairs call it, they happen to be different. The Clinton proposals are by no means as extreme and dangerous as the Bush proposals. And the same goes right across the board. So on domestic issues, the people around Bush are very openly committed to dismantling the achievements of popular struggle over the past century, which have created a certain degree of popularly supported social welfare programs, Social Security, Medicare, and others, a degree of progressive taxation and so on. They want to dismantle all of that to ensure that wealth and power are concentrated to an extent that hasn't been seen for, you know, for a long time, if ever, concentrated in the hands of completely unaccountable private tyrannies. The people around Kerry, I don't like their policies, but they're nowhere near so extreme in this respect. But within the choices that come up on November 2nd, there happens to be a difference. And in my view, it should take about 10 minutes of our time to figure this out and then go on to the important issues.
That was Noam Chomsky, MIT professor of linguistics, author, and political analyst. His latest book is titled Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance, published by Metropolitan. Read more about Professor Chomsky's work online at www.chomsky.info or www.zmag.org. Economic issues being debated in this year's presidential election campaign include unemployment, health care, tax policy, the deficit, and more recently, Social Security. But growing income inequality across the U.S. is one critical issue that has been all but ignored by the candidates and corporate media coverage of the campaign. The U.S. Census Bureau reported in September that the number of Americans living in poverty increased by 1.3 million last year. Alarmingly, children were among the hardest hit segments of the population, with an increase of about 800,000 living in poverty during 2003. During Mr. Bush's administration, 4.3 million Americans have slipped into poverty, and 5.2 million have lost their health insurance coverage. The income gap along racial lines also worsened during the last recession. Analyzing the most recent census data, the Pew Hispanic Center found that white households had a median net worth 11 times that of Hispanic households and 14 times that of African American households. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ellen Frank, senior economist at the Poverty Institute at Rhode Island College and member of Dollars and Cents Magazine's editorial board. Frank examines income inequality and President Bush's campaign proposals in his so-called Ownership Society initiative.
There's no question that inequality has been growing. It's not a new problem. Income inequality began markedly increasing in the 1980s and continued increasing during the 1990s. And there was a brief period at the end of Clinton's term and during his second term when the inequality started to lessen. And that was largely as a result of the very, very low unemployment rates that were prevailed in like 1996 to 2000. And then you started seeing wages at the bottom start to rise. And despite these huge CEO salaries, the workers at the very bottom were starting to capture a bigger share of the national income. But that has reversed itself, and we're now back since Bush came into office to this long-term trend that began in the 1980s of most of the benefits of economic growth flowing to about 20% of the population and the other 80% of the population seeing either stagnant incomes or actual declines in their real earnings after inflation.
Now, a little bit has been talked about on the Kerry campaign side about raising the minimum wage. And, of course, there are longstanding campaigns to work in living wages among municipal workers around the country. But what, in your view, has to happen to change the trend of income inequality in the United States?
Well, I think that raising the minimum wage is a big first step. I mean, one of the reasons for inequality is that wages at the bottom have declined so much, and the minimum wage is, sets a floor to that, and that floor hasn't been adjusted in real terms since the 1980s. The minimum wage in purchasing power is now equivalent to what it was back in the 1960s. And so, raising the minimum wage would really help. Raising it to $7 an hour, as Kerry proposes, I don't think is anywhere nearly enough. It should really be raised to about $8.50 or $9 an hour. But certainly getting it to $7 would be a huge first step. Another thing that would really help, I think, is to increase access to health care and to increase government funding for health care, because a big cause of American insecurity in the workforce that makes people afraid of bargaining for higher wages or of holding out for higher wages or of going on strike or anything like that in order to try to protect living standards is that people are terrified of losing their health care because they don't have access to health insurance outside of an relationship with an employer. And so anything that would expand, public health care systems would be, tremendously beneficial to middle-class and working-class families and will give them greater bargaining power and greater ability to command a portion of national income. And then the third thing, I think, is real efforts at the federal level to maintain full employment. And this can be done through greater employment insurance spending, more generous unemployment compensation that lasts for a longer time. It can be done through concerted efforts at the federal level to provide public works programs, either rebuilding schools or rebuilding our infrastructure and roads and transit systems, whatever. But that requires a real commitment to make sure that unemployment remains low. If we had unemployment rates at 3.5-4%, as we did during those couple of years in the end of the Clinton administration, then we would begin to see real gains at the bottom of the income scale.
In regards to President Bush's Ownership Society initiative, which he's talking quite a bit about in the closing weeks of this campaign, including privatization of Social Security and medical savings accounts. Tell us a little bit about your analysis of what that would do to the income inequality question.
Well, there's no question in my mind that that would widen income inequality. It makes a lot of sense to have, you know, privatized retirement savings and privatized, you know, healthcare savings accounts when you can afford to put away thousands of dollars a year, but most people can't afford that. And if the government is going to take away the income support and insurance part of Social Security and replace it with, you know, a private savings plan, there's no question that the people who are going to do better are the ones who can afford to save the most, and that is, you know, always upper-income families.
That was Ellen Frank, senior economist at the Poverty Institute at Rhode Island College and author of The Raw Deal, How Myths and Misinformation About the Deficit, Inflation, and Wealth Impoverish America. Read Frank's articles in the pages of Dollars and Cents magazine or online at www.dollarsandcents.org. Today, almost 5 million Americans are prevented from voting because they committed a felony crime. Currently, African American men are disenfranchised at a rate 7 times the national average. Depending on what state an ex-felon lives in, he or she may be barred from voting for life, or may have their voting rights restored at some point during or after they complete their sentence. In 2 states, incarcerated individuals may vote, as is the case in many countries around the world. Much of the racial disparity in the U.S. prison system today is attributed to high levels of poverty and the sale and use of illegal drugs, with punishments apportioned inequitably by race. Kalila Brown-Dean, assistant professor of African American Studies and Political Science at Yale University, wrote her doctoral dissertation on the historical roots of this problem. Her work, soon to be published, is titled Stolen Democracy: Disenfranchisement Laws and American Political Inequality. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Brown-Dean about what her research revealed about the history of voter disenfranchisement and what it means for democracy today.
There have been disenfranchisement laws on the books since the founding of the country, but in the post-Reconstruction era, most states tailored their laws to increase their effect on blacks. So as the Constitution gave blacks increased voting rights, these states created these criminal disenfranchisement policies to keep blacks out of the voting booth. And so in the contemporary sense, we still see black and Latino communities being disproportionately affected by the laws.
How many states was this true in? Was it true in the North as well as the South? And can you give any specific examples?
Sure. So the South definitely led the way in enacting these criminal disenfranchisement laws to target blacks. So Mississippi was the first state. And following Mississippi, over a 2-year period, 13 other states began to adopt these laws. Although the South was the leader, the North also adopted a lot of these policies. So one of the ways that they were able to be effective is that the crimes that qualified as felony offenses were based on crimes that blacks were thought to commit more frequently than whites. And the irony there is that if you lived in a state like Alabama and you beat your wife, you lose the right to vote because it was thought that blacks commit battery. But if you killed your wife, you could keep the right to vote because the belief was that whites more likely to commit murder, and therefore it was not considered a disenfranchising crime in that state.
How can you conclude that they actually based their laws on behavior that they expected was more common among blacks than among whites?
The beauty of historical records. So I did a lot of archival research where I was able to find speeches from constitutional conventions where it says rather explicitly, this is our intent, this is our discrimination. You can see the transcripts from legislative hearings. You certainly can't find that same language in contemporary discourse, but in that historical period, it was seen as a justifiable legislative act.
What about robbery or rape?
Definitely. Rape was one of the key issues that were considered to be a felony offense. Rape at that time was not considered to be something that a husband could commit against his wife, and so that was a very important charge. The other thing there is that a lot of the people who were convicted of these crimes were brought up on false charges. So as you saw the collapse of slavery and, you know, the collapse of this labor market, you saw the growth of this penal system. We need a new growth of workers, so let's bring people into a lot of the jails in the South to exploit them as a labor class. And so there were a lot of these false charges, mostly crimes based on things that were classified as moral turpitude. So rape was one. Vagrancy was another act.
Vagrancy was considered a felony?
Right. Considered a crime of moral turpitude and also considered a felony offense. So many of the people who were being rounded up based on this vagrancy charge tended to be black men in the South who then would become a part of this prison labor class.
Right now, you know, certain states, all or almost all in the South, disenfranchise felons for life. And then other places, you know, once you're out of prison, you can vote. Other places, once you're off parole, you can vote. And other places, once you're through the whole system, including probation, you can vote. And I believe there are three states, either Maine or Vermont, and I think Massachusetts is one, and maybe one other, where felons can actually vote while they're incarcerated.
There are two states now, Maine and Vermont, where an individual in prison can still vote. Massachusetts did have a policy, but up until 2000 and 2001, where the governor introduced an initiative to take away the voting rights of inmates. In 13 states, it is a possibility that you could lose the right to vote for a lifetime, depending on the nature of your offense, depending on when you were convicted. But in 32 states, individuals on parole or probation cannot vote.
What can you say about the impact of these laws on African-American women? Were they affected very much?
Most definitely affected. I think one of the things that I want to convey to people with this book and with a general dialogue about it is that we have to understand the impact on the community and communities as a whole. That although we see that, you know, 3 in 10 of the next generation of young black men can expect to lose the right to vote, that definitely has very real consequences, not only for women, but for children as well. As we see an increase in the number of black women and Latinas who are becoming involved in the criminal justice system, that will mean a lot. The gender gap that we see in black voter participation, of why black women tend to vote more often than black men, this has a lot to do with it, the institutional features that determine who's eligible. I don't know right off what the percentages are, but I know that black women out-participate black men by something like 75%, which, you know, has a very powerful impact on political choices. So if your parents are ineligible to vote, or if they are not participating in the political process, you in turn are less likely to participate. So we could be raising a whole new generation of citizens who will not see politics as a viable option for them to express themselves.
That was Kalila Brown Dean, Assistant Professor of African American Studies and Political Science at Yale University. Her research can be found on the Sentencing Project's website at www.sentencingproject.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.bplonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minuth, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.